Hello and welcome to the Philosopher's Zone, a weekly look at the world of philosophy and at what philosophy has to tell us about the world. I'm Alan Saunders, and this week we're going right back to Philosophy 101 and asking what sort of thing philosophy really is. To help me with that, I'm joined in the studio by David Braddon Mitchell, a senior lecturer in philosophy at the University of Sydney, whose work embraces the philosophy of mind, metaphysics, and the philosophy of science, as well as ethics and political philosophy. David, welcome to the Philosopher's Zone.
Thanks, Alan. Glad to be here.
Now, if you were going to produce a caricature of a philosopher, I suppose what you might have is somebody saying something like, "What's it all about then?" But it does seem to me that what's it all about is in a way a very philosophical question, because it's a question about the whole of experience. It's not like, say, what's Hamlet all about or what's plumbing all about. So do you think what's it all about is in fact the basic philosophical question?
That's not a bad way of putting it, especially the all, because it seems to me that philosophical questions, what makes them philosophical anyway, is often that they arise when worlds collide and you have to get a big picture. So take, for example, the world we have of our understanding of the physical universe. You might know a bit about physics, you might know a bit about chemistry, you might have a kind of scientific picture of the way everything ticks. And then you've got an entire other world, the world of your ordinary understanding, the world that involves rights, that involves the notion of justice, that involves love, that involves consciousness, that involves friendship, that involves all those kind of things. Now, normally you can keep those worlds apart. But philosophers are poor people who somehow can't keep them apart, and they clash together, and they ask themselves, how do these pictures fit together? And that's when some of these what's it all about questions, I think, really begin to emerge. How you can reconcile all the different ways you understand the world.
I think it's interesting that you say the philosophers are these poor people who can't keep things apart. There is perhaps a suggestion there that doing philosophy, or even seeing the point of philosophy, is a matter of temperament. I mean, I've encountered people, and I'm sure you've encountered people, who just don't see the point. And sometimes you get people who don't see the point and write about philosophy anyway, and it's very, very apparent that they haven't got the point. Most people who don't get the point shut up about it. But do you think there is a philosophical temperament?
I think there probably is. It's got something to do with, firstly, whether you're prepared to look at the presuppositions that are underlying your own thinking all the time, or whether you're just happy to go along. So, for example, you might be someone who has constantly to make difficult ethical choices, and you've got a kind of a procedure for deciding when you ought to do things, when others ought to do them. You might be involved in some kind of practical ethical program. And somehow it's frustrating to have someone ask you, look, what makes something right or wrong in the first place? And trying to push those things aside makes life a lot easier. And in fact, for practical purposes, it really can be a lot easier. But a philosopher is someone who can't stop themselves grappling with those questions. It is difficult.
There's something in that, it seems to me, that's rather childlike, that philosophers are asking the sort of questions that children ask. Now, you, I know, have written a paper called How Do We Know It Is Now, Now? And that's a rather childlike question. And I remember that when I was a kid, I started to write a history of the world. I didn't get very far. And it seemed to me that a history of the world would have to begin with the beginning of time. And I was troubled by the fact that time didn't appear to have a beginning. It just went infinitely backwards as well as infinitely forwards. I devised a theory to deal with this, which I won't go into now because I have long since repudiated that theory. But again, these are childlike questions, aren't they? These fundamental questions, how do we know it is now, now? How can time go infinitely backwards as well as infinitely forwards?
That's right. I think you're really onto something. I've always myself thought that there's something about that childish tendency to keep on saying why, you know, the annoying way 8-year-olds do. It can be infuriating. And you finally end up wanting to shout and say, look, it's just so. Well, a philosopher, in a way, I think, is someone who hasn't quite grown up. They've kept on with that tendency to ask why all the time. The trick in philosophy is working out how often to ask why. Because there's a certain kind of philosophical question which you've asked why too often, and there's simply no way of beginning to answer it. But you can push back. A few more whys than the received wisdom wants you to ask is, I think, the model of good philosophy. I sometimes think that there's something about the philosophical temperament which may almost literally be childlike. You may know that on some theories about how human evolution has worked, many of our characteristics are characteristics which it was easy to evolve because you could evolve them by turning off the developmental process of apes. If you've noticed that there are a lot of gum trees with large round leaves, the explanation for this is that it's easy for gum trees to evolve round leaves because they all have them when they're little saplings, and all you have to do is turn off the process that makes them pointed. Well, similarly, various features of human cognition, some people think of as being the features of juvenile, curious apes, which somehow haven't been turned off. So humans are curious throughout their life. Some of us are even more curious. We're even more childlike. Our development has been frozen like a young 8-year-old human, and we keep on asking these annoying questions.
Now, you say we keep on asking these questions, and that's a notable thing about the questions that philosophers ask, is that they keep on turning up, these questions, and that seems to make philosophy different from other subjects. Students of physics don't, on the whole, read Newton, and students of biology don't read Darwin. It's historians of science who read these authors. But more than 2,000 years on, philosophers are still reading Plato, and they're still reading everybody since Plato, like Descartes and Kant and so on. That seems to imply, that eternal recurrence of the same question seems to imply that we're not actually getting anywhere, that philosophy doesn't progress.
Two things to say about that. One is that when philosophy really decisively gets there, it gets a new name. So various philosophical issues about the nature of matter and the way in which bits of matter recombined got turned into chemistry. Various philosophical issues about the nature of motion and so forth got turned into physics. So philosophy spins off daughter disciplines. The question is,
and this is happening,
and this is happening
recently. I mean, linguistics was philosophy relatively recently, 100 years or so.
The other thing to say, though, is I think that there is progress, that there has been enormous progress, that we understand the big issues, free will, consciousness, personal identity, all these things much better than we used to. In some ways, we do come back to the same questions, but I like to think of it as a kind of a spiral. We come back to the same place, but we're above where we were before, and we can see a bit more about how it all fits together.
What is the relationship, then, between where I'm talking about, I've talked about science as progressing and philosophy not progressing in quite so obvious a way. What's the relationship between science and philosophy? The great 20th century American philosopher W.V. Quine thought that science, and by that he meant any empirical subject, any subject that dealt with facts from physics to history, he thought that science and philosophy were more or less continuous. He didn't see a hard and fast distinction. Do you?
I'm inclined to agree. It depends what you mean. One interpretation of what Quine meant was that philosophy was continuous with science because philosophy was a species of behavioristic science, really, just observing what people say and do. I'm not sure that's quite the right way to read him, and I certainly don't take that view to be right. But if you think that the core intellectual tools, the core intellectual disciplines, the core methods of arguing are continuous and the same, then I think that's exactly right. Philosophy is what's left when you can't do the experiments. When there are questions which you've got to sort out using the methodology, using the reasoning, using those sorts of tools, but where there's not an empirical matter that you can deal with, then that's what philosophy does. So, for example, a lot of contemporary philosophy consists of taking the findings of an empirical science and then, as it were, doing the interpretation again. Now, that last paragraph in an article in a biology journal, interpretation, done very quickly because you're much more excited by getting the lab results. Well, often there's a whole school of philosophy, the philosophy of biology, which is all about taking the results and then thinking very slowly, very carefully, very seriously about what the consequences of the results in biology are.
A lot of biologists, though, would say, well, when it comes to the interpretation, we can do that. Yes, it's only a paragraph at the end of the paper, but that's because a paragraph is all it's worth. I mean, there is a widespread feeling amongst hard-headed scientists these days, isn't there, that philosophers really don't have anything to tell them, or indeed to tell anybody else about the world.
It's probably least true in biology. If you think about some of the most interesting biology written by biologists of late, it's often things by, for example, Richard Dawkins, and what he's doing is philosophy. And if you look at who he's arguing with and who's taken seriously in literature, it's other philosophers like Kim Sterelny, for example. So, yeah, I think philosophy does have a lot to offer, especially in the realm of biology. In the case of physics, for example, in The City we have Hugh Price, who's published in Nature and engaged in very interesting debates about the nature of quantum reality, trying to sort of think very seriously, not in a kind of, you know, crazy, hey man, this quantum world is weird kind of way, but take very seriously what to say about the nature of the direction of time and the nature of the direction of causation and all these things in the context of what physics has discovered.
So the impression I get of a lot of scientists holding philosophy in very low esteem, you think that's a mistake, do you?
It's a sociological truth for some scientists. It's certainly a mistake to do it, although, of course, it would be not a mistake for some philosophers, because not all philosophy of science is good philosophy of science. But I do think that there are enormously important contributions that have been made, because philosophers have a role as kind of a generalist. That when your particular discipline comes up against other disciplines, when there are kind of borders between it and other ways of thinking, then you need someone who has those generalist skills, who knows enough about everything to be able to put it together. I wish I knew enough about everything to be able to put it together. You need someone who knows enough about the different areas and enough about reasoning in general to put these stories together, to forge a coherent picture, to be able to say, what's it all about then?
So we end with the question with which we began, very philosophical of us, what's it all about? You've been listening to The Philosopher's Zone. Details of this and every program on our website, just go to www.abc.net.au/rn and follow the links to The Philosopher's Zone. David Braddon Mitchell, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
A pleasure.
And you can join me, Alan Saunders, in The Philosopher's Zone again next week. Meanwhile, stay with Radio National for Occam's Razor, presented by Robin Williams.